Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Baroness Jane Campbell. A contrary character, she seems to have spent her life proving people wrong. The doctors, who, when she was an infant, gave her less than a year to live, the disability charity, which told her she was too disabled to work for them, and the medics, who believed her life wasn't worth saving. A pioneering disabilities campaigner, she says, "You take the hand you are dealt, and believe me, if you said to me that I could be born tomorrow without my condition, I'd say, no thanks. I am me because of my condition, not despite it." So, Jane, that seems curious to me, because on the one hand, I can imagine that you may be the sort of character who doesn't want to be defined by your condition, yes, but at the same time, it has defined who you are. Explain a bit of that to me.
Well, I think, as you, we're all defined by our experiences. It's the nurture or nature argument. And I think in my case, all of my life, I have learned through experience. I have learned through watching and observing and feeling how the world fits together. So for me, my life has taken the course that it has because I am a disabled person who basically needs another person to live. And that, for me, has been a really, really interesting, sometimes difficult, sometimes frustrating journey.
The condition you have is spinal muscular atrophy, and in order for you just to go about your business every day, you need somebody there to help you, because it's a degenerative condition that means that you're not able to do the things with your arms that most of us would need to do just to get through the day. And you also, it affects your breathing too. At night you have to be put on, is it a ventilator?
Yes, a breathing machine.
How does that affect your sense of self in terms of your privacy?
Well, yes, I think people not in my position, they often tell me, oh goodness, I could never ever have carers in the house, you know. My privacy would be just shot to pieces and it must be awful to have to rely on other people. Well, actually, I feel that I can be alone if I want to. We can all be alone in our heads. That's where I probably get my privacy. In terms of having people around me all the time, well, in most cases, it has been an absolute privilege. You know, I've had hundreds of women and men come into my life to drive me, to dress me, to do my hair, and each one of those persons has given me a little gift of understanding. And I probably understand people more than most people because I've had a lifetime of observing and trying to understand them. And all I would say is, you can be private. I am private. I've got up to the most naughty and mischievous things, and I haven't really missed out one little bit.
You celebrated your 50th birthday not long ago. It was a milestone that you weren't expected to reach. What did you do? Do you have a party?
Oh, I had a huge party and invited all my friends and colleagues. And I pretty much do every year because, as you rightly said, I've never been expected to live beyond my first birthday.
We're going to have some music, Jane. Can you tell me about the first piece of music we're going to hear this morning? What is it and why have you picked it?
Well, this is Mott the Hoople and All the Young Dudes. When I was young, I absolutely adored rock music. It's very much alive, it's loud, and it annoys the parents. And so, being a bit of a rebel, but not being able to do many rebellious things, I had a kind of music rebellion. And luckily, my sister, Sharon, she would sit with me in her bedroom and she would dance around. And the fact that I can't dance doesn't mean, say, that I'm not dancing in my head. And when he's stealing clothes from Marks and Sparks, and Freddy's got spots from ripping up the stars, from his face, funky little boat race. The television man is crazy, same with juvenile delinquent Rex. Oh man, I need TV when I got T-Rex. Oh brother, you get, I'm a good man. All the young dudes. Hey, dude!
That was Motley Hoople and All the Young Dudes. So, Jane Campbell, you've been chair of the British Council of Disabled People and the Social Care Institute for Excellence. You founded the National Centre for Independent Living. You've been a commissioner on the Equality and Human Rights Commission. I mean, I could go on. I won't, because, you know, we've got to fit the whole programme in, but it's an impressive career. Topping all of that, in 2007, you were made a people's peer. I haven't actually been into the House of Lords. I don't know how many wheelchair users there are in the House of Lords. How many?
More than you would ever think. And a lot of scooters, because, of course, some of our more elderly members are using scooters to get around. And they are so dangerous. Some of us have been using our wheelchairs since a wee thing. We kind of know how to get in and out the chamber without demolishing an entire row of peers, not the scooter users.
Right.
The appointments bring diversity. People like me. Well, you're not political, so you're there to do one very, very important thing, which is to revise and make legislation fit for purpose.
There are plans, of course, to reform the House of Lords. They're still on the table, and the idea of these reforms would be that it would be an entirely elected second chamber, entirely democratic. Somebody from your political background, I would think, could only welcome an entirely democratically elected chamber.
I would if democracy welcomed disabled people. It's incredibly difficult to get elected as a disabled person, not just because of the stereotypes that society holds about us in that, you know, oh, they're lovely, but they couldn't really cut the mustard. So we have all of that. Then we have the environment. Can you imagine me going round door to door knocking on people's houses asking them to vote for me? I mean, I can't even get out of their driveway.
Is it true that your father told you when you were very young that you were destined for great things?
My father definitely believed that I was destined to do something special. And he was one of the most formative people in my life. Wherever the family went, I went too. And he did not accept she can't come in here, ever. And he was a big bloke. He was a 6 foot, gorgeous looking, very charismatic person. I remember the times when we go to museums and cinema, when they say, oh no, she can't come in, she's a fire hazard, or she can't come in, she'll get in the way. And of course, he would then grow another 6 foot and look very scary and say, she's coming in and I am her legs, so there'll be no problem. And as far as I know, we were never turned away after that.
Let's have some more music, Jane. It's the second disc of the day. What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Frank Sinatra. And it was a very good year. Because, as I said, my father was highly charismatic. He lived a very full life. And he thought that he was either Frank Sinatra, James Bond, or Captain Kirk of the USS Enterprise. And he lived that life. And he was loved by everyone, including all the ladies. So listen to the song and you'll know just what he's like.
It was a very good year for city girls who lived up the stair with all that perfumed hair. And it came undone when I was 21.
That was Frank Sinatra, and it was a very good year and memories there for you, Jane Campbell, of your father, who you say was a big character, a charismatic character. And your mother was no shrinking violet either. What sort of person is she?
Well, she was married to the lovable rogue, so you can imagine she needed to be extremely strong. She's an extraordinarily strong woman who has dealt with, you know, she had two kids who had spinal muscular atrophy at a time when there were no resources, no support for women with severely disabled children. So she just got on with it. And in a way, that was quite good because I felt very ordinary, very normal.
How were you treated by your big sister when you were growing up?
Just like any other big sister. She bossed me around. She was very ordinary with me. She never, ever felt sorry for me. In fact, quite the opposite. She thought it was a real swiz that I didn't do the washing up or the household chores. So she thought I was spoiled and needed to be brought down a peg or two. Actually, things haven't really changed.
You're close now, though, are you? You get on.
We're extraordinarily close. All the Campbell women, that's my mother and my sister and myself, are all quite strong personalities. So when we're in the house together, well, some people can stand it.
And how would you get on with other kids in the street? I mean, did they include you?
Oh, yes. Well, the thing is, because I had such a dreadful time at special school and I didn't really have any friends, so my life really started when I got home. And because I was quite good at organising games, the kids in the street loved me, and they must have loved me so much that I had a whole queue of people ready to push me, because we didn't have electric wheelchairs in those days. They were my route to freedom, and so I had to be really good at making them want to be with me. So I was a game maker.
Let's have some more music, Jane. What are we going to hear now?
Well, we're going to hear Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto.
And why have you chosen this?
My mother adores piano concertos. She's a huge romantic, and she gave us all a sense of romanticism that has carried us through our lives. And we must have watched this film, Brief Encounter, about five times when I was young. And it's all so romantic.
Ashkenazi playing part of the second movement of Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto with the Concertgebouw Orchestra conducted by Bernard Haitink. So, Jane Campbell, you described your father as charismatic and persuasive, and you've described yourself as a young girl as organised and, well, I've written down here manipulative. I mean that in a benign way. You know, you got people to think it was fun to push the wheelchair and get involved in the games that you knew you could fit in with. They all seem to be, if you've taken on some of your father's characteristics, great attributes for somebody who's working day to day in the House of Lords. Would that be fair?
I might call it persuasiveness.
rather than manipulative.
Manipulative. I like to persuade people that there is another way to live. You have to persuade people that not only is it okay to be like this, but that actually you could love them, need them, want them. And of course, my father was adored. because he was such a big character. And so I guess, yeah, I am a chip off the old block.
So you had an older sister, and after you were diagnosed as just not even quite a toddler, but you maybe were around about a year old when your mother thought you weren't
11 months.
11 months, right. Your parents were told, is this right? They were told to go home and enjoy the time they had with you.
Yes.
Yes.
Go home and enjoy her mother, because she probably won't live the year out.
Right.
So that was tough. Mum told me she didn't look at me for 2 weeks. I had to go and stay with my grandmother. But then she just brushed herself off and got on with it. I mean, she is a coper.
You were sent to a school, you described it earlier, as being entirely unsatisfying as far as you were concerned. At the time, it was a special school that was described as one for the incurable handicapped. Can you take me through a day? What would you spend your time doing?
I used to spend the majority of the time either in the physiotherapy department or having a nap. I did learn to read and write, and in the final year, they thought, oh gosh, this little one is bright. I did 2 CSEs, but nothing for years. I was bored out of my mind.
Tell us what we're going to hear on your 4th track.
This is Fairport Convention, and The Fotheringay, and this Sandy Denny has the most beautiful voice I have ever heard. And this song about a bird that's caged, I don't know, it just touches a nerve.
How often she has gazed from castle windows all, and watched the daylight passing within her captive wall, with no one to heed her call. The evening hour is fading.
That was Fairport Convention and Fotheringay. So something of a caged bird yourself then, Jane Campbell, at school. But you did find a way out. You went to college and you got some exams. How did that actually happen, that you went from sort of not being taught at all to suddenly passing exams in a relatively short time?
Well, I guess I went to what was the disability grammar for kids who didn't get an education. I began to learn what it was like to do proper lessons, to read proper books. And it was just a joy. And I just ate it up like a hungry lion.
Did you feel like your life was suddenly happening in colour, having been very black and white at school?
Oh, yes, it definitely started moving into colour. Especially when, of course, I got my first boyfriend, because there were boys, and nice boys, intelligent boys, one particular boy that I was destined to marry later on. So it was fantastic. Just think, education and sex. It had all been denied me.
I have you down as probably quite a good flirt. Are you quite a good flirt?
Well, so some people say.
And what would you have been... I mean, today you're wearing... Because you've got red hair, I should tell people, and you're wearing sort of tones of peach and brown and things that go with the red hair. You like to take care of the way you look. How would you have looked when you were a student? What were you wearing?
Well, I've always liked clothes. I've always liked to dress up. My mother was a very, very beautiful woman, and she always instilled a sense of you must look good because you are good and you're gorgeous. I mean, the reason I think that I feel so comfortable about myself is that my parents instilled in me from a very early age that I was beautiful. And, of course, that helped enormously, because most disabled women don't actually feel that they're beautiful. Not really, not deep down inside.
So you and Graham was the man who would go on to become your husband. What was the first time you met? What happened?
Well, basically, he was gorgeous. I have to say, he was very able-bodied. He had hemophilia. And in those days, amongst the disability culture, you tried to go out with the most able-bodied person that you could, because somehow you were getting as normal.
Yes, that validates you. Yes, yeah.
So I did set my sights on him. And yes, I fell in love, and he was this lovely, strong Yorkshire lad from the Dales, and everything that I wasn't.
How was your health generally then? I mean, given that, you know, your parents had been told this is a little girl who will be lucky to survive beyond the age of two or three, here you were at university, living as independent a life as you were able. Was your health generally pretty stable at that point?
No, not at all. I mean, my life goes from being totally healthy and talking to you like this to being in crisis. So I would catch a cold, that would go down on my chest, I'd catch a chest infection, and then I'd be in big trouble. And that would happen two or three times a year.
What does that mean? That means being hospitalised?
It means hospitalised, not being able to breathe. Clinical team ringing up my parents saying they didn't think I was going to live. My poor parents went through that time after time. I mean, I have had times when I definitely thought, oh gosh, this is it. And it's quite extraordinary that I'm still here.
Let's have some music, shall we? Tell me what we're going to hear now.
We're going to hear Elton John and Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. Graham loved Elton John. He had all his albums and they were played over and over. Well, there were three in the marriage. Myself, Graham and Elton John.
When are you gonna come down?
That was Elton John and Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. I said, do you like to be called Baroness Campbell? Does it feel quite... put a swish in your tail when you hear that?
Well, I quite like it when I'm in the House of Lords and they say, good morning, Lady Campbell, because I'm looking round to see where this person is. And then I think, oh, that's me, I'm here. How exciting. But actually, I liked it when I became a dame because I went around being Dame Jane and I thought, oh, I'm just like Judi Dench now. Great.
So your first job then, long before you were a dame, was working for a charity for disabled people. I mentioned in the introduction you were, rather unfortunately, regarded as too disabled for them. Can you tell me briefly what happened?
Well, don't forget, it was in the days when there were charities for disabled people, and actually disabled people were pretty absent. Having the Crips in the courts wasn't quite what they wanted, and they put me to something that was very physically demanding. And of course I tried, because I thought in those days, God, I've got to do everything the same as non-disabled people. And of course I failed, even though I'd got a master's degree. You know, they said that I just wasn't up to working.
And so through your experience at your first school, and maybe also partially through your experience at work, I mean, you became, would it be fair to say, radicalised? Is that who you felt yourself to be then, radicalised by your experience?
I met a group of disabled people who said, enough is enough. We want to be let in. For example, I would find myself sitting in the middle of Westminster Bridge, bringing the traffic to a standstill. And of course, I helped organise very big demonstrations with over 1,000 disabled people to campaign for the Disability Discrimination Act. You know, the police didn't know what to do with us, whether to pat us on the head or, you know, put a handcuffs on us. They were quite confused.
During that period, you were married for the first time then, and you found out that your husband, Graham, who you've mentioned before, was a haemophiliac, became ill. How quickly did you know that he was seriously ill?
Well, we learned that he had the HIV virus 6 weeks before our wedding, so that wasn't a great start.
It being contracted through a blood transfusion?
Yes, it was the most awful time of my life, I think. And probably the thing that made me the most angry, we were able to keep Graham at home until he died. But, you know, it ruined his and my life. And I've never felt so scared in all my life. I realised my rock had gone, and not only had he gone, basically I fell apart.
I think we should have some music, Jane. What are we going to hear?
Johnny Crescendo and Choices and Rights. Johnny was one of the main leaders of the more radical fringe of the disability movement. Choices and Rights is what we fought for and what I'm still fighting for.
I want choices and rights. Choices and rights. Choices and rights in my life. I don't want your charity. Are you to be paid to care for me? I want choices and rights in my life. And I don't want to be in your care. Or to be put someplace out there. I want choices.
That was Johnny Crescendo and Choices and Rights. So, Jane Campbell, in recent years, an area you've been very vocal in is the assisted dying debate, a very hot topic. You have argued very strongly against a change in the law. I'm sure influenced not least by your own experiences. You were once admitted to a hospital where the medics weren't used to dealing with your case and didn't know you as a person. Can you tell me what happened?
When I went into hospital with my routine chest infection, I was extraordinarily ill, as I always am. And the doctor who was clerking people in, and I was then with my second husband, Roger, and he turned to Roger and said, your wife's very, very ill. I presume she won't want to be resuscitated in her condition. I was too ill, I was out of it. And thank God I was with somebody, and Roger said, no, you must do everything that you can to help her. What do you mean in her condition? And so I was treated, and then they had to put me in intensive care. And yet again, they said, well, look, she must be pretty much at the end of the road. And he was so afraid that he came back and he grabbed the picture of me getting a doctorate, and showed it to the people there and said, this is my wife, not what you assume you see in the bed. You treat her like you would treat any person.
The assisted dying debate raises very strong feelings, understandably, on both sides of the argument, and there are many people who are the movers and shakers behind wanting a change in the law who are themselves people who suffer from terminal conditions, who have degenerative conditions, and who say they absolutely respect that you don't want to do not resuscitate on your notes. You want to live your life for as long as you possibly can, but that they also have the right to say, I want to decide my time's up, that I've had enough, that what I perceive as a struggle is not a struggle worth having. And surely they also have that right. They have the right to be protected and catered for within the law.
It's a very, very tricky one. And I don't underestimate individuals' views that they have the right to decide. But we also have to think what effect that would have on others in society. And I believe that if we cross that line, then we would put hundreds and hundreds of other disabled and terminally ill people at risk. And I just think that until we live in a society that values people like me in the same way that they value you, then we cannot go down that road, because it is a dangerous road and it is unsafe.
Let's have your seventh choice of the morning then, Jane Campbell. What are we going to hear?
Well, we're going to hear some Yes, Prime Minister. I've always loved politics. I've always wanted to be in politics. Yes, Prime Minister is exactly how it happens. I know, because I've seen it.
The party have had an opinion poll done. It seems all the voters are in favour of bringing back national service.
Well, I have another opinion poll done showing the voters are against bringing back national service.
Well, we can't be for it and against.
Of course they can, Bernard. Have you ever been surveyed?
Yes. Well, not me, actually. My house. Oh, I see what you mean.
Well, Bernard, you know what happens. Nice young lady comes up to you. Obviously, you want to create a good impression. You don't want to look a fool, do you?
No.
No. So she starts asking you some questions. Mr. Woolley, are you worried about the number of young people without jobs?
Yes.
Are you worried about the rise in crime among teenagers?
Yes.
Do you think there's a lack of discipline in our comprehensive schools?
Yes.
Do you think young people welcome some authority and leadership in their lives?
Yes.
Do you think they respond to a challenge?
Yes.
Would you be in favour of reintroducing national service?
Well, I suppose I might.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Of course you would, Bernard. After all you've told you, can't say no to that. So, they don't mention the first five questions and they publish the last one.
Is that really what they do?
Well, not the reputable ones, no, but there aren't many of those. So, alternatively, the young lady can get the opposite result.
How?
Mr. Woolley, are you worried about the danger of war?
Yes.
Are you worried about the growth of armaments?
Yes.
Do you think there's a danger in giving young people guns and teaching them how to kill?
Yes.
Do you think it's wrong to force people to take up arms against their will?
Yes.
Would you oppose the reintroduction of national service?
Yes.
There you are, you see, Bernard. The perfect balanced sample. So, we just commission our own survey for the Ministry of Defence. See to it, Bernard.
Nigel Hawthorne and Derek Folds discuss leading questions in Yes, Prime Minister. You mentioned then, Jane, that you are married now for the second time to Roger. You say that he fell for you when he saw you give a speech. When did you fall for him, and what was it about him that captured your heart?
His sense of comedy. I can get through some of the dark times just because I see the comedy in the situation as well. And I lost that sense of comedy, and I lost the ability to laugh when Graham died. And to be honest, Roger brought laughter back into my life. And also a sense of normality and a sense that one doesn't need to take themselves so seriously.
I was suddenly reminded there, as you were talking of your father and this person you described as being, you know, persuading everybody in the street that he was the man to watch and he was the sort of top of the pile, and him telling you that, you know, you're going to go and do something extraordinary one day, Jane. How often do you think about him? Is he somebody who's still sort of present in your head in this very vivid inner life that you have?
My father was larger than life, but he wasn't an easy man to live with. I know that wherever he is, and I don't have any faith, but wherever he is, he's looking down and thinking, ha, there she goes. I knew I was right. He believed in me. And I think when your parents believe in you, you're unstoppable, don't you think?
I agree entirely. On that note, we'll have your final track then, Jane Campbell. What are we going to hear?
This is Van Morrison, Have I Told You Lately? And I think there's a line in the song that says, you fill my life with laughter. You know, when somebody comes in to your life and makes you laugh again and loves you and you have a second marriage that is as blessed as your first, you really have got it all. This is the track that we played at our wedding in the New Forest.
Have I told you lately that I love you? Have I told you there's no one above you? Well, my heart with gladness, take away my sadness. Ease my trouble, that's what you do.
That was Van Morrison and Have I Told You Lately. So I'm going to give you the books now. You get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, Jane, and you get to take another book too. What would you like to take?
Well, this is a tricky one for me. I actually like to take a very good atlas because I had to choose my subjects to get them all done in time. So I never did maths and I never did geography. And, you know, we're going to Italy this summer and I hardly knew sort of where Italy was. So I want to know more about the world.
Right, it's yours. I shall get you the best atlas that money can buy and a luxury too. What would you like your luxury to be?
Well, you know, it's got to be a super souped-up electric wheelchair with Caterpillar tyres, solar-powered, and, of course, with robotic arms so that I can build my own shelter. Otherwise, I'm going to be really stuffed.
I'll give you that. It's certainly yours. And if you had to choose just one of these eight discs, which one would you save?
Well, I'd have to choose Sandy Denny and Fotheringay because, quite frankly, I'd feel pretty scared and caged on that island. So I'd need to fly away as soon as possible.
That's your disc. Jane Campbell, Baroness Campbell of Surbiton, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much. I think it's been enjoyable.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.